Welcome to the XYZ Experiment podcast. Today we're going to talk about academia. And with us, we've got Katrina. Welcome, Katrina, to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And we've also got Luke and Dash.
Hello.
I'm really, really excited about this episode, actually. As someone that's kind of in research at the moment, looking at my future, it's very, very exciting. Before we start with that, though, Katrina, when we have a guest on, the first question we always ask is, what generation are you and what is the most generational thing about you?
So I'm Gen Y. The most generational thing about me, I suppose, is my transition experience. So I have really fond memories of looking for papers and looking for books in the library using the file system.
Then
I remember it transitioning to encyclopedias and then the CDs of Encyclopedia and Carta and stuff like that online, and then the web. I find that Gen Ys are really good at knowing how to do things analog and how to do things in technology space. And it makes me better at finding stuff in the technology space because I know how to use search terms. I know all the different methods I can go to find something. So I think in some ways Gen Ys are really good detectives because we've had to learn the different systems so we can kind of walk between worlds. So I find that probably the most Y thing about me. I'm not about the experiences. In a lot of other ways, my values are more Gen X because my parents are both baby boomers and we grew up with this value of you work hard, you get your reward.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting adapting to an environment where that doesn't actually work anymore, but I still have those innate values that if I just keep working hard, someone will give me the reward, like I will get a house, I will get all of these things if I just knuckle down, save and work really hard. And dealing with the fact that that doesn't always work has been really interesting.
I've never thought of it like that. It's true though. It's very true. That philosophy doesn't exist anymore.
Really.
It doesn't. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you, Katrina?
Oh, so there are two identities dominating my world. I'm a mum to a three-nager. And I am a early career researcher that is still trying to work out what that even means. And both of those things happened around the same time in my life. So change in identity of both, and it was during COVID. So change in identity to be a mum and be an ECR and work out how to be an academic and how to be a mum and how to be a married partner as well, all at the same time during COVID.
That's a lot in a lockdown situation. Wowzers.
Was COVID an advantage or a disadvantage?
For academia, for me, weirdly, it was an advantage.
Okay.
I was very lucky. I was brought on to a project just before COVID hit that was in its last phase. There was some space to do more research that I actually already delivered a year early, which is unheard of in my experience. So I was brought on and I could spend some time kind of developing new programs, writing grants. So that was really lucky. If COVID had not happened, we would have been still doing a secondary trial. So it would have been trial delivering versus having that time to write grants that was funded. So that was very extraordinary. Having a kid during COVID, not so good.
Yeah. And so I guess as Fiona said it and Luke said at the start of this episode, we're going to talk about all things academia. And one of the reasons we were so keen for us to have this conversation is I think most people don't know what academia is. You know, I don't think it's necessarily helped by some TV shows that are out there as well in terms of the picture it paints or also maybe what a traditional view of an academic was. And so there's potentially opportunities for us to do some myth busting when we're chatting today. And I wonder whether or not, Katrina, how would you describe an academic?
Oh, God. I have yet to come up with a definition or explanation that my dad understands. So for me, and I suppose there are two different types of academics, which have our traditional research only and teaching and research. And I'm a teaching and research academic now, so it's a bit easier to explain. So for me, academia is about creating new knowledge that makes the world better and also helping the next generation of new innovators and knowledge finders to reach their potential so they can go on and make the world a better place.
I love that. It reminds me of Scott's episode where he, it's just so inspirational that makes sense. You're making the world a better place, because I don't have that in my career, and just it's incredible. How about you, Dash?
Yeah, I love that definition as well. And I know that the university that we work for has as their logo, and in Latin it translates to "I am always learning." And that is one of the things, like whether or not you're wearing a research hat or a teaching hat or a service hat or whatever it might be in the academic space, of which there are many hats, I think we need to say people wear, or very diverse roles in university, which I don't think people necessarily appreciate. We are always learning, and there's this culture of learning and curiosity and I think experimentation, regardless of what discipline or science you are. And so I really love that.
But I suppose the one thing I didn't mention, that's the impact we want to create. The reality of what we do, I think, is what people don't understand.
Yeah.
So we are project managers. We are human resources people.
Yeah.
We are writing grants. We are doing day-to-day data collection. We're doing data analysis. We're managing our team. So the best way I've heard it described by one of my project officers is, she's like, you're a startup company who can't operate like a startup because you're in a massive institution and you need to follow their rules and use their systems at the same time. Like, there are over a dozen different systems that we need to know about and manage on a day-to-day basis.
And they change all the time?
Yeah, and we have to manage our budget, so you have to know a bit about accounting. You need to know a lot about stakeholder engagement, but also dealing with consumers. Like, the amount of different tasks that you do, especially as an early career researcher, before you have a team that you can delegate to, is extraordinary. And anyone else I know in their job have different people in departments that do those bits for them.
Mm.
And while we have some resources, most of them are business partners or in an advisory capacity, the day-to-day management is all us.
Katrina, I was just going to ask, how, for those listening, how does one become an academic? Because I imagine to some people it's, okay, you go to university and then you just kind of never leave.
I think that's a less common pathway in the colleagues I see. My pathway was a bit odd. So I'm kind of an accidental academic. I never intended to be one. So I was high achieving at school. I was a nerd. I went on lots of space and science camps because I wanted to be an astrophysicist. I took a gap year, and then I really wanted to be a teacher. And my mum, who was a fabulous high school teacher, told me that's the one profession I would be horrible at because I understand things too easily, and so I wouldn't be able to explain them to people who struggled. So I took that to heart, and I did what a lot of people were doing in Queensland at the time in my generation, and did a science arts degree for people who weren't quite sure what they wanted to be. And I got into ANU, which was fabulous. I got a scholarship to go down there and kind of spread my wings a bit. And I did physics and chemistry and psychology in my first year. And then I did sociology, ancient history, and poetry in my art side, because I really wanted to explore. I just wanted to understand why humans are and why existence is. And I had that science lens from the physics, but also the humanities of history and learning from historical mistakes and patterns. And it landed me on psychology. So I specialised in psychology. And then I had multiple years of failing at university and struggling with lived experience of depression and anxiety. So left university in my third year, moved to Melbourne for love, and worked in managing backpackers for a couple of years.
Wow.
And I was on the books for management consultancies and other temp work, and everyone's like, you're too smart, you'll get bored. Like, you're doing this awesome degree, you'll go back to that, so we don't want to employ you. So I went back and finally managed to do my honours at ANU in psychology, because I wasn't really sure if I wanted to be a clinical psychologist, but I wanted the option, and that's the only pathway. And then I came back to Melbourne, I'm like, then what? And I looked for a lot of kind of office administrative EA, PA jobs, or kind of research assistant adjacent jobs. And everyone kept saying, you're too smart, you'll get bored, we don't want to hire you. So I'm like, suppose I need to look for something else. And I saw a PhD advertised, and it was in mental health. and it was in organisational psychology, which is, I suppose, more working with groups and organisations to create wellbeing and prevent some negative things for people. And I'm like, that sounds what I care about. I'll just put my hand up, and I got it. And I'm like, well, I have no other job opportunities, so let's do this. And then from there, led more research assistant stuff, and I kind of just kept walking down the path as this is where people are giving me a job, so I will just keep going in this direction. And so I got my PhD.
Does that get funded? Like, how do you afford to do your PhD?
It somewhat gets funded. So I was lucky, and I didn't understand any of the processes at the time. So I thought I was signing up for an organisational PhD that would give me an organisational psychology qualification. But the year before I had signed up, that program had been disestablished at Monash University, which I did not know at the time.
Oh.
Yeah. And one of my supervisors was the person that ran that program. So I had made that assumption. I hadn't understood about the registration complications. I was lucky that I didn't have to go through the extraordinarily, especially now, competitive grant application process for a funded grant, a funded PhD. I was employed on a specific research project, and sometimes these research projects have dedicated funding for a PhD student to do a specific role in the project. So for me, it was more a job interview that led to some funding. But my PhD took 6 years because I had ongoing mental health issues. So the funding at the time was $27,000 a year. But if you went part-time, that cut down and you're only allowed to work 8 hours a week. So I lived on less than $30,000 a year for 6 years.
Shivers.
And a lot less later on. Yeah.
Wow.
And how did you do that? How did you survive off of that?
I was lucky in that my gap year before I even went to university, I worked 2 full-time jobs. So I worked from 5 till 2 in one job and then went and did another job from like 2 till 7, 6 days a week.
Oh,
so I had a bit of a nest egg, which was good. And then I always worked, so I actually found tutoring in my honours year, and surprise, surprise, I found I was good at it. So I'm like, ha, mum, I can be a teacher.
Mm.
And then that reinforced the idea that I wanted to be a lecturer, that I could probably do this. So I was teaching psychology units while I was doing my PhD, and then in the last year of my PhD, I worked full-time while trying to finish it, just because I'd run out of money and funding, so I needed an income source.
Can I ask this question of both of you?
Yeah.
Just hearing that, okay, why would you become an academic?
Because I couldn't get another job. For me, that was the reality. I couldn't get another job because people kept saying, you're too smart, you'll get bored and you'll leave.
Mm. Wow, that must have been hard. That must have been hard hearing that.
It was frustrating because I had some of those sliding door moments. I had a job, I was probably about 20. I went back for Christmas up to Brisbane, and my brother's girlfriend at the time was supposed to do a temp job. She pulled out because she had got a real job. And she said, do you want to fill in? And it was just a receptionist for an IT company. I was only there for 2 months, but by the end of it, I was EA to the managing director. I'd written all of their technical manuals. I was doing their HR and their invoicing and their reception work. And I got a job offer from the managing director. He's like, you want to stay? Yeah. He's like, and now I checked a couple of years later, they were a multinational corporation.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, no, I need to go back to university. And I'm like, I kind of sometimes wish I'd done that route because it was so much easier. Like, it would have been really easy for me. The pay would have been better, less kind of stress and hassle. But for me, there is always this curiosity and love of learning.
Mm.
I can't turn my back on intellectual challenge.
Yeah. Is an academic only someone who works at a university, or can you be working in a private entity as an academic?
I don't know if they have that title.
Yeah.
But we have, and we'll get to this soon when we're kind of talking about the results from our survey, but there are lots of people with academic qualifications or a background in research who are working all over in lots of different organisations.
Yeah.
And there are lots of people that do research or research adjacent work that are also not academics. So if you think about even market research companies use a lot of academic methods of surveys, qualitative data analysis, we will probably say it's not at the level of rigor that we do, but they do similar work. We have lots of scientists that are based in pharmaceutical companies and things like that, that are doing research and creating new drugs and interventions, but they're not, I suppose the difference is they're not publishing.
Yeah.
So the pursuit of academia is to create a new knowledge base and to share that with other people so we can build on each other.
Yes.
And often in private areas, that sharing doesn't occur.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think just to add on to that as to, it is interesting, the accidental academic story, because I do think it actually happens more often than we realise. Like you do honours and then you might do some casual RA work or you might do some tutoring. And I did the same thing, you know, became a tutor, and you just start to fall into these contracts or casual contracts, and they keep rolling and opportunities keep coming. And it's interesting, the PhD scholarship thing, because I don't think people realise how low they are. And, you know, for both Scott and I, we were both on scholarships at the same time and trying to survive. And because, you know, it was more than 10 years ago, the scholar, I think they were 27. Now they're 35 maybe, but still it's not.
It's nothing.
It's nothing. They're tax free, but they're still very competitive to get. And it's really hard. And I don't think often people going into academia know all of that. Mm. No one tells you that's what's going to happen or that's what it's going to look like, or they're the sacrifices that you might need to make. So we kind of just fall into it and go, oh yeah. But it is that drive for learning and that drive for curiosity that often kind of sucks you in.
I just wanted to circle back again. Sorry, this is what I've fixated on from that story beforehand, Katrina. I think I can imagine a lot of people when they're thinking about potential jobs, thinking, okay, I'm going to be bored, so I'm not going to pursue it. But for a potential employer to actually say to you, no, I think you're going to be bored, you're not going to get much out of this. Was that potential employers in the research sector, or was that just in just other professions?
No, in lots of different professions. So even the temp recruiting agencies that I talked to, a lot of the office admin stuff was like that as well. I also did a whole lot of work in hospitality for some of the large stadiums. Mm-hmm. And it was similar, that it was that I got promoted quite quickly to leadership or management roles, like within 3-6 months. And then like, now what next? You're going to get bored eventually. You're already progressing faster, changing processes, making improvements. At some point, you're just going to get frustrated. And my response was always, while I'm here, I'm 100% here, and I want to improve things and use all of my skills, as long as there is a path for progression and to help make everything better, I'll stay. Like, I will be entirely happy. And I think it's that pursuit for knowledge and improvement constantly that I was seeking. But people didn't trust me on that.
That's really interesting, because those are qualities that I would imagine most employers would be looking for in their staff. So it's interesting that having those qualities is what led you to kind of the pursuit of academia.
Where you never feel like you're actually living up to those qualities.
No.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah. Imposter syndrome is a thing.
Yeah. It's bloody hard.
I just saw you react immediately to what she said. What do you mean? What do you mean?
You choose to surround yourself by people that are, by definition, as smart or smarter than you. So often being, you know, the most competent person in your area, you go to be the tiny, tiny fish in a giant pond, and there are always people who are better than you.
Yeah.
But to become a professor, you need to be an internationally world-renowned expert in a very specific field. So you need to climb that heap. You're compared against your peers constantly. And then the amount of work that you have to juggle. For me, academia is very similar to motherhood. I feel like I'm juggling so much that I'm doing nothing at the level that I would like to do and that my value tells me I should do, is high quality, connecting with people, all of that, I just feel like everything's juggling and I'm going to drop it at some point. But the only way to prevent myself from dropping things is to do everything at an okay standard, which for someone who chose a profession where you're striving for new and innovative and high quality all of the time is really uncomfortable to sit with.
And I would also just add the metrics of measurement in academia are archaic, I would say, and probably reflect the academic world of the past. But the standards back then, like if you were an academic 50 years ago, you would be considered a good academic if you maybe published a paper a year, right? I've been told, as someone who, you know, transitioned from, I did my PhD, then I was in an education-focused role, then I was in a teaching and research role, and now, bizarrely, found myself totally unexpected, got a fellowship, research-only role, it's coming to an end, and so I don't know where I'm going to end up. But I was told I need to be publishing at least 20 papers a year, right, to keep myself competitive for grants. I need to be getting CIA grant funding, which is highly competitive. Like most of our schemes have a success rate of 8% or lower. One scheme in particular, which was just for early and mid-career researchers, had a success rate of 4%. And so these grants on average take us weeks and months to write, often in our spare time, and then they don't get up. So then you're thinking, I'm here for the pursuit of knowledge and impact and improvement, but I'm spending all my time on things. And it was like what Katrina was saying before, the effort reward or the, you know, the amount of things that I'm doing and someone is now going to say, yes, that was good, doesn't always get achieved because you get rejected from the journals and sometimes you have to submit your paper 10 times before it gets published. You don't get your grants up, but you're also trying to run your projects and do data analysis and supervise your staff and do HR and manage your budgets and just keep everything running. So, yes, you have to be okay as being people who are probably type A personalities to begin with suddenly being like, I have to be okay with this not being excellent and I have to be okay with, like, just coping.
Who's telling you it's not excellent? Is that your own inner voice or is that peers? Like, I imagine it's probably excellent, but I stand to be corrected.
Well, when you have those sorts of rejection rates of a grant, so our grants are always judged on level of innovation or level of impact, the ability to change people's health outcomes. And when you get it back that you were rejected with scores and usually no feedback or no feedback in scores at all and just said, nah, not good enough, that's what you're getting all the time when you submit journal articles. Sometimes peer reviewers are fabulous and it's kind of great critical commentary that can make the paper better. But sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it will be things like design or errors in data collection that you can't fix after the fact.
Yeah.
And you know that that was an issue, and you know, especially in some of the work that Darsh and I do, trying to recruit the people that we work with is incredibly difficult. Mm. So you're dealing with tiny sample sizes and people are like, it's not a quantitative study with 10,000 people, so it does not matter.
Yeah. And I think I started to learn, you're going to get rejected anyway. So sometimes I'm like, just get it to the 80% mark and submit it because I've got to move on to the next task. Mm. I just don't have enough hours in my day to do everything as well as I possibly can. And so, yes, there's definitely an element of that self-awareness of what I think is excellent, but also we are getting rejected constantly. Like the rejection is actually incredible. And I often think in other sectors, you can write a report and submit it and they'll say, yeah, great. Like that was your deliverable. If my deliverable is based on the peer review of other experts in my area who sometimes don't appreciate our research or don't get it, then they are making a judgment call on your work, which may not be founded on reality.
But now even our deliverable isn't that, it's impact.
Yeah.
So as an early career researcher, for me to go for promotion or for grants, I need to prove that the research that I have done has led to policy or practice change in healthcare provision. How do I do that when I have been doing this job now for 5 years, a couple of years out due to having a kid? That's not enough time for things to ever be picked up, and there are no real mechanisms or specific funding to help sustain the things that we develop. So you create an intervention, you trial it in a setting, people like, great, we love it. The research funding then says, well, that's not new and innovative anymore. So there's no funding from us for you to continue or roll that out to wider sites. You need to find a partner or get the government or someone to spend money to use that. And that almost never happens because our health systems are poor. All of the partners that we work with are doing in-kind work and are struggling for funding as well. So a lot of it comes back to this, there is no money to continue the work. So trying to get impact is almost impossible.
Yeah.
Unless it's a really sexy and cool area that everyone thinks is the most important area at the time.
Like COVID had a bit of impact stories because it was a big problem at the time.
Can I ask a question that is not so much academia? It's just something that's going through my head as I listen to you both talk. Really, your jobs are quite unstable, as in when's the next dollar going to come? How do you get things like home loans and things like that? Oh, no, seriously. Because I know, how does that happen?
I went through that recently, actually. I had to find the right broker and the right lender.
Yeah.
The first couple I tried did not understand. And my situation at the time was incredibly complex. So because I was on maternity leave, I was on a one-year fixed-term contract, even though I had 3 years of competitive grant funding that had salary for me.
Mm.
I had proof that it was going to continue. I had proof of the funding. I was also doing casual sessional teaching on the side at the time because my funding was only research specific. And I had to get paper. I had to get documents from HR. I had to put all of this together, history of payment slips. Luckily for me, I haven't moved institutions much, so I've been at Monash, so I have a long history of employment at that institution, so they were more comfortable seeing my pattern, but that was a strike against me that I didn't have a permanent job.
Mm.
And when I went to refinance, I now have tenure, which is very rare, and I've had to do teaching and research to get that ongoing position, and that was partly because I wanted security for my family, but it's tenure at 0.6. So if I want to work full time, I need to get 2 days a week worth of competitive research funding for myself and now my 14 members to keep all of us in a job. So proving that to the bank, saying, so I have ongoing funding at 0.6, but at the moment I have competitive grant funding that can pull me up to one, but it's only going to last for this long. Again, it was an incredibly complex process to show them all that information for them to take a risk.
And when we first bought our place, like the first apartment we bought, we were only on 1 year contracts at a time, both of us. Actually, had I finished my PhD? Oh, but I was working full time and then finishing my PhD. So I had a 1 year contract. I had worked at the university, and this is not uncommon. I'm not bashing our university at all. This is a very common thing that you're just on 1 year contracts because no one knows what funding is going to come through. And even if it's on a 3 year or 5 year grant, they still put you on a 1 year contract because I think they just think it's easier. So I had to get letters from my supervisors to say, yes, she's on a 1 year contract, but we plan to employ her again. And so you just had to pull together a whole lot of information and again, find a broker who knew how to navigate that because it's not usual. And that was something that our survey also showed, like, you know, the majority of our academics, what was it, 46%?
No, 58%.
58% were having contracts that were finishing in the next 12 months or so and didn't know if they were going to get renewed.
Oh, so it was 58% that are on fixed term contracts.
Yeah.
And then out of the whole sample was 12% that were not sure if they would have a job by the end of the year.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you just sit there and think, there's so much investment into becoming an academic. There's so much that we can do and value add. And, you know, if we want to prove impact, that's a long-term process. You know, if we aren't still there, who's going to pick up that work? Who's going to keep it going? The work that Katrina and I both do, we work with a lot of external people to the university, which is a priority. It's a priority for government as well. Those are relationships that we have with those organisations. If we were to go, who would pick those up? You know, there's all of this kind of stuff around the sustainability of the work that we do that is in question if our contracts don't get renewed. And I don't know if mine will get renewed when my fellowship ends.
And that's one of the challenges, I suppose, of doing research in universities versus some of those private roles, your projects are yours. Your ideas are yours. When I went on mat leave, all of my stuff stopped. No one could pick it up and do it. There's no cross-role training. There's no one that you can job share with to do a lot of that stuff, especially at the more complex and senior end of what you do.
Mm.
So if you are sick, your research stops, which affects you, any of your team, which affects your trajectory, affects your publications, which affects your ability to get more funding, which affects your ability to come back from that and do well. So any interruption in your career has a multiplicative effect on your ability to maintain a career in the space.
So this has got to affect women more than men because of maternity leave, surely. Is it harder for female academics?
Interestingly, our study found that care responsibilities were fairly evenly balanced okay. between men and women. And one fantastic thing that the university sector does really well is parental leave.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bit more complicated for my male colleagues because to get more leave, the birthing partner also needs to be a university employee for them to get long entitlements.
Okay.
Otherwise, they still just get their 2 weeks. They only get yeah. 2 weeks. We get, I think, so you get a full year
yeah.
At 60%. I think it's the first 18 or 20 weeks at full-time pay, mm-hmm. which is fabulous. But for me, I got pregnant. I had all of this time during COVID to write grants. I was incredibly lucky. These are the first grants I ever wrote for three of them to get funded. That meant, though, that I had to come back from maternity leave incredibly early because I couldn't postpone the projects. I managed to postpone the one that I was CIA, so lead investigator, on by 6 months, but I couldn't postpone it any further. So I had to come back to work when my bub was 5 months old.
I did not know that. Goodness.
Yeah. Well, I took a phone call after I'd given birth while I was on the ward because I'd gone on maternity leave, but they didn't know I'd given birth and they needed to check something about a grant and a contract process that only I had access to that system. And then I was doing a symposium presentation with him strapped to me when he was less than a month old. I was writing a grant in the couple of weeks after his birth because it had to go in. So I was doing all of this stuff and you have to still be available and keep doing things because ethics processes are attached to you. Some of the contract and grant stuff is attached to you and people can't access the systems if it's not you. So I was constantly in touch with the university over that yeah. time, even though I'm not allowed to. HR would yell at me for knowing, but I was because I had to be.
That was the reality.
Yeah.
And I think, like, women are, we do know that there's stats that there's not as many women professors as there are male professors. And I think that comes back to some of the historical elements of, you know, how academic work is structured, and that it is something that, you know, our funding bodies are looking at, like, how do we get parity and who gets funded for grants and all of those types of things. But back to the point of we can't switch off. Like, I was writing my fifth attempt at a fellowship application while I was an inpatient in hospital. And my right arm wasn't working, like I was having a neuro flare. I couldn't use my right arm, so I had my laptop balanced on my legs in my hospital bed, typing with my left arm, cannula in the right arm. And the neuro team walks in and says, I think your neuro symptoms are because you're stressed. Like, look at you. Like, look at you. And I was just like, I am stressed, but this is normal. Like, this is... We function at a very high level of just being stressed and doing overtime and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I'm not saying it's normal. But I remember submitting that grant and thinking, it's not going to get up. And that was the fellowship that did get up. And it was like just this remarkable thing of thinking, I almost didn't apply because I was an inpatient in the hospital and was very unwell and couldn't move half my limbs. But I did because that's what my job requires me to do. And I was thinking, I'm not going to have a contract if I don't do this.
But Dash, can we warn any future or current early career researchers who are listening, don't do what we have done?
Yes.
I was just thinking, it just seems so unhealthy to me, such an unhealthy work-life balance.
Totally. But that's the norm. And I suppose when I say don't be like us, we're trying to shift the norm and trying to shift the norm for our team. And I think there's this myth around kind of millennial bosses, and that the millennial boss is like, oh, don't work any more hours, don't work overtime, you take that leave that you need, you be sick, I'll pick it up.
Yes.
So a lot of the time we're picking up the stuff for our junior staff members and students and trying to give them an environment that we didn't have, but that means that we're carrying more. So 100%. We're trying to make the generational change. We're just at the cost of ourselves sometimes.
And, you know, if we go back to the survey, so we had 668 early and mid-career academics fill out that survey across Australia. Only 17% would recommend people become an academic.
So just tell me, what exactly is the survey? What was it?
So it built on some work that colleagues from Monash and Melbourne did in 2021 to try and get a sense of, just at those universities, what's the reality of early and mid-career academics, what's their well-being like, what's the workplace culture like. And we wanted to do it again, and we were lucky to have support from Research Australia to reach out to a lot more of our universities around Australia to collect data from them. So it's a survey based on just emerging medical and health researchers and academics. So that's kind of all of our background, and we wanted to focus on that. The original kind of the theory was that especially those sorts of lab-based researchers and scientists would have a really tough time, and they have a stereotype of how much they are overworked and the insane hours that they do. So this was a survey looking at impacts of carer responsibilities, impacts of different job roles, so those teaching and research versus research, on well-being, in terms of anxiety, depression, stress levels, burnout,
mm-hmm.
also understanding just what our workplace kind of looks like. There was a lot on workplace culture and also on bullying and discrimination and harassment and poor academic practices. We really just wanted to get a snapshot of what academia looks like for this cohort, because there is no data on it. We don't know what it looks like, and it's even really hard to know who qualifies as an early or mid-career academic. We don't have national statistics on that. We have national statistics on what level you're employed at. So if you're a research fellow or a senior research fellow or an associate professor or professor, but that doesn't always align with stages of your research career and how many years post PhD you are, which is how we define an early career researcher. And even if we define it that way, it doesn't take into account any of those career disruptions of having a kid, being ill, care responsibilities, being a part-time worker.
So it's typically 10 years post PhD that we kind of see as that early and mid-career stage.
Is the results what you thought they would be? Anything surprise you?
I was surprised that the carer stuff was as equal as it was, to be honest.
Yeah. And I was surprised. So we found that people with caring responsibilities didn't necessarily have a worse time of it than other people. We did find, which doesn't surprise me, that teaching and research staff versus research-only staff have a harder time. But we also interestingly found that part-time staff don't work more percentage of overtime than full-time staff. We thought that if you're part-time, you're doing more overtime that's unpaid just to try and keep up. And that wasn't really the case. It seemed the more senior you were and the more you were already employed, the higher your fraction, the more overtime you still worked. So it was more kind of relative to your full-time equivalents of how much you were working.
Yeah. But I think the biggest thing is, like, job insecurity is a massive thing that I think drives a lot of the uncertainty that academics are experiencing. And, you know, you do sit there and think, oh, if I was working in industry or some of those other roles still wearing a research hat, I may get bored because I'd have to be doing research within certain constraints, but I'd be getting paid a lot more and I would have job security. So there's pros and cons, I think, to the academic life, but job insecurity for particularly our cohort, on average, you know, they're in their, you know, 30s to 40s. You are wanting to buy houses, you are raising children, you are, you know, trying to navigate that life stage. So you do think about those things.
As a research assistant fly on the wall to a lot of these issues, I do see in my colleagues, it's really interesting that personal responsibility that comes with the work and the responsibility it puts on you. And I wanted to ask, because as you mentioned, Dash, I think that a certain personality type tends to find themselves in research. And so as a result, even like up and coming academics that are around my age, I see them falling into that kind of already overworking themselves, already kind of burning out, kind of accepting that they're going to be taking on a lot more of just the responsibility of this work than maybe they anticipated. Is there a high turnover rate for academics, or are there just people that go, you know what, I can't do this anymore, I want the stability, even if that's like anecdotal from just, you know, your personal lives?
I think anecdotally, I don't feel like I have seen people, well, I have seen some people leave, but the majority of us have stayed. But the report did say, I think there was like over 40%
were 43%
were considering leaving. But I think one of the things I know for myself, that I know if I left, I can't come back.
Mm.
It's very hard to leave and then come back into academia. And so it's like, I often think it's like breaking up with a person that you really, really love, but there's like some challenges and you think, I just still really love it. Like, I don't know if I can give up on it yet, because I know that I may not be able to come back in.
Why is it hard to come back?
Because all of that time out doesn't get count. Considered as relative to opportunity. So when you're applying for grants, if you've spent the last 5 years working in government doing policy related to your area, those 5 years you still have are expected in grant land to have done the same amount of publications as you would if you were a full-time academic. So you still need to have had grant funding and publications and PhD supervisions, even though that is not your role.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So it is very much publication based. That's like a huge metric for success.
It's starting to change. And so, you know, beforehand, they would definitely count the number of publications. Now in a lot of the grants, you need to just list your top 10 best, and I don't know how much they actually see your full record, but that's still bloody hard to get 10 very, very good publications. But it's for promotions. Often you need lots of publications. And so because I was going through a promotion round, I was like, oh God, I need a lot of publications to show that trajectory. And it depends on which discipline you are in and all of that kind of stuff. So publications are still a big one.
And it's not just publications, it's first author or senior author publications.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be the person that has done the most work designing, data collecting, writing it.
Mm.
And so as an academic, like going into academia, if you wanted it to be a long-term prospect, does it feel like then most people just all they want to do is work related to publishing articles instead of, you know, actually kind of trying to produce the change maybe that brought them into that profession to begin with?
I think that's the challenge in the transition that we're currently in, is that we're moving towards impact assessment, but assessing impact and how you make that change is incredibly difficult. So the university and grants programs still rely on that assessment of publication quality and tangible, where your publications have been cited. Have they been cited in government reports? That sort of evidence to show that you were making a change to the academic knowledge base or an impact on the area you want to make a change in. So mm-hmm. we're in this space where you can't prove impact without those publications. They're still needed, but now they're looking at impact factor of your publication. So how many times have people cited you? What quality journal has it been in? Which again is incredibly subjective, because at least for me in my field of implementation science, the top journal is an open access journal, which means you need to pay $3,000-$4,000 to publish your article in there.
Yeah.
Like, we can't use grant funding for publications. So who pays for that? Do I pay for that out of my personal pocket?
And I was having this conversation recently because I was like, okay, if the expectation is that we publish about 20 articles a year, and, you know, some of them might be from my PhD students or RAs, or I might not be the lead author, but we all might chip into it. But, and they on average might cost $3,000. So 20 times three is a lot of money to try and find that is not funded by your grants to pay for a metric you're being measured against for your performance. But I wanted to come back to something you just said, Luke. I think, though, there are still some academics who are like, I have to publish and I have to get grants and I'm going to focus on that. And they might do that at the cost of developing their team or at the cost of engaging with community or at the cost of like building stakeholder partnerships, because that actually takes a lot of work and a lot of time. And at the moment, that's not reflected in our metrics. So I'd really love for the number of genuine partnerships or engagement opportunities that you've developed to be something that is recognised and valued, because if we want impact, that's how we get impact, is through that pathway. No one actually reads the papers, I don't think.
Yeah, because that's what I was just reflecting on. I found like in the last 6 months or so, a lot of the work that I have been doing has been some of the most rewarding work that I've done in research so far. But at this stage, it's not really anything that would be contributing to a paper or would turn into a paper. And even though I'm loving it, there is that like kind of underlying discontent when I hear other people talking about, oh, I'm doing this and it's becoming a paper and I'm publishing it. And even though I don't really care that much about that, it's really interesting seeing kind of that internal conflict that comes with that.
Mm. You also need those publications for things to be on the record. So one of the challenges for me when I went to have my bub is I had most of my publications that were still outstanding from those projects either in reasonably complete draft form and I was second author and they were with someone else to finish, or I had some data collection that had been done and I needed to reanalyze them when I came back. I came back and again, super lucky to have the grants that I did, but that was jumping straight into delivering those really complex projects and three projects at once, which had initially funded me at, I think, 1.2 fraction. So 6 days a week on top of them, my teaching commitments. So I had to employ junior staff to do some of that work, which meant that I still haven't finished publications from 2019 that are sitting in draft form and some of those authors walked away. But I'm doing research that was based on that research. So now I have publications that I want to submit that are referring to things that I did a couple of years ago, but they're not on the record yet. So it becomes really hard to prove impact, to talk to stakeholders, people like, where's the publication? Where's the information? And I can share conference presentations, but I don't have that record. So you have to get things out quickly so someone else doesn't beat you. And so you have a record that you can build on and that people can see what you're doing. And that gets hard when you have career disruptions.
But we do love the work we do.
So to finish off then, why would you become an academic?
Because you're a glutton for punishment. I think because you care.
Yeah.
We are all, I think, optimists in the fact that we think we can make the world a better place. We can help students be better. We want people to reach their potential. We want the world to be a better place. And we think we can maybe do something about that. I really envy clinicians because they get to see the impact with each client. You get that feedback. And I get some of that when I'm teaching, but not as much anymore because I'm a mean lecturer and there's a big power gap between me and my students now. But the work we do, we're trying to create a much larger impact, but it takes longer and it's a lot harder to see. But I think that's why we do it, because we're not content to do it one person at a time. We really want to make big systemic changes.
And I would agree with that. And I think one of the things that maybe reflecting on some of the conversations the other employers had of you and saying, you're going to get bored or you've already progressed so far. One thing I feel like academics are really quite good at, which is a myth that we are disconnected from society. I think the new academics, this generation of academics coming through, are very connected. The work we do is very much in connection with organisations and with society. And so we often see problems in a different way. We see the opportunity for solutions in a different way. Both Katrina and I work with aged care organisations. And, you know, how amazing would it be to fix the aged care system? Like, that's what gets us out of the bed and kind of working alongside people who are on the front line but also sitting there thinking, we have the critical thinking and the headspace and the resources through academia to potentially value add to the work that this workforce is trying to do on the ground. So I think academics are usually very passionate about their science and very passionate about making society better. And what makes me sad is if the narrative that we're hearing from this survey is that only approximately 17% are recommending people become an academic, are we going to lose this workforce? How are we going to sustain and attract this workforce? Things definitely need to change. But I still think it's a great career. We just have to have some systems change to make it a career that's sustainable and one where we can thrive and make that impact.
A system that supports that connection, yeah. Where we can go and work in policy or work in practice and come back and share that cross-role knowledge. Yeah. For us to create impact, we need to be connected with stakeholders and not just them as external people, but us being in their organisations and them coming back. That whole clinician researcher model that we want people to be clinicians but also connected to the research at the same time. We want our researchers to be connected to clinical practice or whatever type of practice it is and to policy so we can do that work together. At the moment, there are no mechanisms for that, for us to even do professional roles in grant bodies and things like that. Take time out while you're having a family and go and learn about how you do research finance or research grant applications, how any of that works, so we are better at what we do and make lives easy for the people that we work with because we know what they do.
Yeah. Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.